Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders Live. In the My Seven Wonders podcast, I ask a special guest to select and talk about the seven wonders of his or her world. This episode is one of several we recorded in front of a live audience at the 2022 Edinburgh Festival Fringe. And the guest who's joined me for this recordings is a comedian who has degrees in biochemistry and education. She was born and brought up in Birmingham, for a while was a teacher at a school in the East End of London. Long since established now as an impressive stand-up comedian, she's now touring her new show, Coconut. So here we are with an enthusiastic Edinburgh Fringe audience exploring the seven wonders of Shazia Mirza.
I always used to get you mixed up with Clive James.
Yes. Well, it's easier now because he's dead.
Dead.
Yes, sir.
But I had to Google that today before I came on because I thought, I don't want to get the wrong one.
No. You know? Well, you've got the wrong one, as it happens. But no, I get lots of conversation about this. And people, they half mix us up and always have done. So they'll be chatting away and say, oh, I love your work. And they start naming programs that Clive James presented. And, oh, is that Margaret Krakatoan? Have you got her on? And how far into that can I interrupt to say, that's not me?
That happened to me last night. I was in the bar and somebody came up to me and said, oh, my God, I just love you. I think you're amazing. I listen to you on Radio 4 all the time. And then a friend came along and she went, Sarah, come and meet Shappy Corsandi.
Oh, right.
And I just didn't have the heart to tell her she'd been terribly racist.
But if you let that conversation go on and then it turns out the mistake has been made, they blame you. They say, why did you let me carry on like that? Because I didn't want to interrupt.
The other night I had people come to my show because they thought I was Omid Jalili. That's going a bit far.
That is going a bit far. Anyway, Shappy, it's good to have you. So you've got a show here. So tell us where it is.
The Gilded Balloon Paterhouse.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's called Coconut.
Coconut.
Yeah.
Now, is that a slightly pejorative term? Are you using it in that sense?
No, I was on the island with Bear Grylls.
Yes.
I did Celebrity the Island with Bear Grylls. I'm a celebrity, you know. Look where the fuck I am tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I did, you know, it was a lot about coconuts and survival.
Yes.
In that. And it's also about Sajid Javid being a coconut. I don't know if these Guardian readers know the term.
Yeah.
But it means brown on the outside and white on the inside. It's a term used by brown people about other brown people who are not seen to be helping the cause of brown people.
Yes.
And there's a few of them in government.
But it's any stick to beat people, isn't it, really? It's the... Would you use the term integrated or involved in society? That's what are you doing there? But if you stand aloof and you keep to only the ways of your parents and grandparents, there's people moan about that. It's a difficult thing, isn't it?
And that's what I talk about in the show. It's like pulling up the ladder behind you.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in charge of immigration in the government, why you shouldn't immigrate or deport your own people?
Yeah.
Yes, because then there'll be none left to support you when you need the help.
Yes.
So it's all about that.
Yeah,
really.
I get that. But you're known, often described as a fearless comedian.
I don't know what that means.
Well, you've mentioned already going on the Bear Grylls program. That was a. Did anyone see that, or would anyone even consider doing that? It was tough, wasn't it?
I don't know why they call comedians brave and fearless. Yeah. I mean, we don't save anybody's life. I mean, we tell jokes and most of us die on stage every night.
Yes. Well, that's the term we use. But you're right, it isn't quite as dangerous as that. But that was a dangerous stressful thing, I
that
imagine.
That was a dangerous thing to do. Yeah. I was on the island with Mark Watson. He was the other comedian.
Yeah.
But then we had Olympic athletes on with us, Sharon Davis, Ewan Thomas. Yeah. I mean, it was a survival survival program. Yeah. And I do relate it to survival, like in the pandemic and yes. survival in life, and how women yeah. are better survivors than men.
Are they? They're more adaptable to the well, the hot and the cold and the pain and the, yeah. the grief. Like
and
childbirth.
Life.
Yes.
I mean, when we were on the island, there was 5 men and 5 women. In the end, all the women survived and only 2 men.
Had you eaten them?
Well, we tried to kill a couple because yes. They were useless. We were starving to death on the island, and the alpha males couldn't find us any food, so we just killed them.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, they had to leave. They couldn't cope. They found it really difficult.
But the other reason why people say you're a fearless is because you have been brave enough to do some jokes that go, after 9/11 you made a couple of jokes and...
I said is that it wasn't me.
Yeah.
I kept getting asked this question every time I went on the radio. Do you know who did it? Do you know who's behind it? Like, we have one big WhatsApp group, like where we all know what every other brown person is up to.
Yeah.
And I just, in the end, I just said, look, it's not me.
Well, obviously it wasn't you. They were suicide bombers, weren't they? So
I could have been a failed suicide bomber. We had a couple of those.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So I just came out and did this one joke where I said, my name is Shazia Mirza. At least that's what it says on my pilot's license.
Yes. Yeah.
It was 20 years ago. I mean, it's okay for people to laugh now, isn't it? Yeah. But I did it like 3 weeks after the event in New York. And so it blew up a bit, you know. The joke, everything just blew up, and it just like it was controversial at the time, but now it's not because you see what comedians do now.
Yeah,
I'm not controversial at all.
Well, yeah, no, and you made a sort of reasonable comment, an analysis of the jihadi brides, you know, their reasons for wanting.
I did. I mean, look, some people think I'm controversial, but it's really people like ISIS.
Yeah.
And extremist organisations, you know, like the BBC. And I did some jokes about jihadi brides because I used to teach. I used to be a teacher in Tower Hamlets.
Yes.
And I used to teach some of those girls. There was Shamima Begum and her 2 friends that went over to Syria. And I used to teach in the school down the road from there.
Yeah.
Where it was all Bangladeshi girls. So I knew why these girls had gone. It wasn't like they were fanatics or religious or terrorism or politics. It was cock, you know? This is
in all senses of the word. Yeah.
This is inside information.
Yes.
Now.
Yeah.
You won't read about this in the Guardian.
Yeah. So they were like girls in the way other girls might run off to follow pop stars around.
Yeah. It was like these men were fantasized and idolized and circumcised and radicalized. You know, these girls were horny. These men were hot. They went over there and they were like, these blokes.
Yes.
You know.
So just because you... No, I remember being... It was sort of focused on the time, but it's a perfectly fair analysis of part of what was going on.
It's nothing new, because women like men, they've always been attracted to, like, the forbidden, the dangerous and the slightly evil.
I know, you don't need to tell me.
I mean, the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, he used to get letters from women every day asking him to marry them, you know.
So you just touched on that you were a teacher for a bit, so just to fill in that sketch before we get on with your wonders. So you studied biochemistry.
I did biochemistry at Manchester University because my parents, you know, they came to Birmingham from Pakistan, so not much difference in the 1960s. And they wanted, you know, like all immigrant parents, they wanted their kids to be doctors and lawyers and all that. And they said to me, you can only go to university if you do a degree in biochemistry, if you become a doctor.
Right.
And obviously I didn't want to be a doctor. And so I did went to university, did biochemistry, just made drugs the whole time and took them myself and, you know, just kind of didn't take it seriously at all. And then I had to do something in that area, so I became a science teacher and I taught in an East End comprehensive.
So you didn't particularly take to that, but were you always thinking from age, you know, when you were 5, I want to be a comedian? No. Or did that come along later?
When I was growing up, my mum always used to watch Larry Grayson, Kenny Everett, and Frankie Howard.
Oh, right.
She really loved the gay comedians.
Yes.
I don't think she realised they were gay. I think she just, oh, these men are very interesting.
Yes.
And she always used to have them on TV. And I used to love Les Dawson. I just used to watch these comedians on TV and I used to think, that's great, it's funny, that's what white men do. I never, ever thought that I would do that or that I could do that.
Yeah.
So it was never a possibility and I never thought of it.
So when did the thought occur? When you were teaching and getting laughs from the under 15s or whatever they were?
Yeah. I was teaching in the East End in Tower Hamlets and the school was really rough.
Mm.
I think they call it, professionally, they call it challenging.
Yes.
Yeah. But it was rough. And, the kids, they hated me. I hated them.
Yeah.
And we just used to make each other laugh to pass the time by.
Yeah.
And I used to tell them jokes just to kind of entertain them. You know, it was very difficult keeping 30, 16-year-olds interested in photosynthesis or, you know, like the periodic table. They weren't interested in it, and neither was I. and so I just used to entertain them, and I realised I was doing stand-up. But right. I didn't realise it till a few years later.
Yeah.
And then when I started doing comedy, it was way easier than teaching in Tower Hamlets.
Yes.
Because everyone was like facing in the right direction.
Yeah. And they wanted to be there. Yeah.
And no one tried to stab me, you know, after the gig.
All right. Well, let's hope we don't get any stabbing tonight.
All right.
So
All right.
let's start with your wonders because we're time is flying by. So your first wonder is a comedian, Robin Williams.
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
So when I started comedy I went to America, it was strange because after 9/11 I was profiled on CBS 60 Minutes in America as being like the first Muslim woman female comedian in Britain.
Yeah.
And they wrote about me and everything and people kept asking me to go to America. So they asked me to go to San Francisco and do some gigs.
Yes.
And I did this gig at this theater called Mill Valley in San Francisco, just out in Mill Valley, which is a little village outside San Francisco. And I didn't know this, but Robin Williams lived there. And apparently he used to go there every Tuesday night. They had a comedy night on. Yeah. And he used to go there and try out material.
Yeah.
And people used to say this, but I mean, I turned up to this gig and I was on and I walked into the dressing room, which was like just this crumply old dressing room with a brown sofa. And they used to order this pizza, which came from the local pizzeria. And I walked in and Robin Williams was sitting there.
Oh, right.
Eating pizza.
Brilliant.
And he just said, hello. And I said, hello. And we just stared at each other. And he said, are you on? And I said, yes, I'm on. Yeah. He said, I'm going to come and watch you. And I thought it was really weird because I just kept thinking about Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah.
Because I'd watched that film like about 10 times and I loved it and everything. And I went up and I did it. And I did my gig and it went really well. And then he said, that was really great. You should carry on. You're really good. Yeah. You're really funny. And we just sat in the dressing room afterwards, just me and him.
Oh, fantastic.
Having pizza.
Yes.
And it was really strange. He was very quiet. Mm. He was very, very introvert.
What sort of stage in his life was he? Because there were times when he did sort of cocaine and other things. He's already an excitable person.
It was
went over the top.
It was a year before his death.
Oh, so very recently in that sense. Yeah.
It was a year before his death. And it was strange because we had the same manager. He started telling this other comedian in the dressing room that he'd fallen off the wagon and he'd start drinking again.
Yeah.
And it was just really strange because a year later he had passed away. Yeah.
So he passed away in 2014. So this is 2013 sort of time. So I'm assuming he still had his powers to as a comedian because
he was still trying out new material.
Yeah.
I mean, he went on that night and he tried out some new jokes.
Yeah.
But people knew him because it was a village. Mill Valley is a village and it's where he lived. So the locals would always come and see him.
Yeah.
I don't think many people knew outside there that he used to perform there every Tuesday because it's not like loads of people used to go and see him there.
Right.
And it was just such a strange experience. And it was strange because he said, do you want a photo with me? And I said, yeah.
Yeah.
I never thought of that. Yeah. And I had my photo. I had my photo.
So you've got that as a, as a.
And I always look at that from every so often. I always look at that and I remember that.
All right. Yeah. I've met him. I've interviewed him a couple of times, but interviewing him was just sort of, hello, Robin, I see that. And then he'd do 20 minutes of entertaining. Yeah, yeah. He'd say, thank you very much, Robin Williams. Yeah, that was about the amount of interviewing I had to do on both occasions.
But I thought he was very quiet. That's what I remember about him.
Yes.
It was just very quiet.
Well, maybe that was an indication of. The misery that lay behind some of that. Maybe. So obviously a brilliant comedian, but would you say your comedy relates to him at all, or is it just you happen to?
No, it's nothing like that. But I think those greats like Robin Williams, Richard Pryor, Joan Rivers, George Carlin.
Yes,
they were one-offs, and they were people who were of their own.
Yes,
now you could say there's a lot of. There's a lot. I mean, when I started, I was the only Muslim female stand-up. But now there's kind of five or six of us.
Yes.
There's quite a few of us. But I think that those people were one-offs.
Yeah.
And they were kind of revolutionary because they were the first to kind of do their kind of comedy.
Yeah.
And so I think whether your comedy is like theirs or not, you really admire them and they're kind of special.
I suppose you might say your comedy is a little bit like Joan Rivers because she was also one who to say outrageous things. She certainly did jokes about for the next day after 9/11. Quite extraordinary ones. But she certainly got away with it because people kind of said, "Oh, that's Joan," most of the time, anyway. So
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so Robin Williams, your first to wonder. Your second wonder is your singing teacher, Glyn Jones.
Yeah, well, when I was teaching and I didn't really want to teach, I thought I might like to be a pop star.
Okay.
I don't know. I just thought I'd like to. And so I thought, I can't sing. So I really need to learn to sing, really.
Right, okay.
A bit, maybe, if I want to be a pop star. So I looked up all these singing teachers, and I read that, Annie Lennox had this singing teacher called Glyn Jones, and he also used to teach the Spice Girls and Rick Astley and all these people. So I kind of, Googled him, and I found him. I tracked him down, and he was working in this little shed in the back of a house in Chiswick.
Okay.
I rang him up and he was proper Welsh, like Glyn Jones. He was a big, fat Welsh man. He had the accent and everything. Yeah. And he said, "I'm sorry, love. I only teach people with recording contracts."
Oh.
And obviously, I was teaching science in Tower Hamlets.
Yes.
I never had a recording contract, but I lied to him and I told him I had.
Oh, right.
I said, "Oh, yeah, I've got one. Yeah. I've got one."
Did he want to know who with or which company or anything like that?
He did ask me. He said he reeled off some names like CBS and all this, and I said that's it I'm with them. And he said great. He said, "But I only teach on Tuesday afternoons." Of course, I'm teaching on a Tuesday afternoon, so I had to lie every Tuesday at school and say I had a doctor's appointment because I had a bad back. But they started getting suspicious.
Yes.
So one day I just fainted in the middle of the classroom while doing an experiment.
Yeah.
I just passed out so I could get to my singing class.
Right.
And Glyn Jones, he used to put me in at 4 o'clock because he knew that I was working till 3:30, and I used to get on the tube and I used to rush to him.
Yeah.
And I used to see him for half an hour.
Because in case people aren't familiar with the geography of London, Tower Hamlets to Chiswick, that's almost all across London.
And I was always late.
Yes.
I was always late. But I walked in and he had all these pictures of famous people on the wall, and I thought he's going to make me famous.
Yeah.
But I was terrible.
Oh, no.
I was really awful. But
my question was, how far did you get? Assumed you got to a stage where you could sing a bit.
I told him everything. I told him I was a teacher. I was teaching Tower Hamlets. I was teaching science. I hated it. I wanted to be a pop star. I didn't have a recording contract. And he still kept me on. And he still tried to teach me. And he still said, "Okay, this is what you want to do. I'm going to teach you up. Everybody else has got a recording contract, but you haven't. But I'm going to keep you on."
Yeah.
And I thought, not many people would do that.
Yeah.
And he trained me up and he believed in me. I was still awful. but he kind of loosened me up and... I was very repressed, and he helped me to come out of my shell, which actually helped me then when I became a stand-up comedian.
Yeah. Right, so you've put a lot of effort into your showbiz because you went to drama school as well.
I went to drama school.
Did you have to bluff your way in there?
Yes, I did.
Right.
I was still teaching then, and I started going to Rose Bruford in the evenings as well.
Where is Rose Bruford? Is that North London?
That's in Sidcup in Kent.
Sidcup in Kent.
I went from Tower Hamlets to Sidcup in Kent. And then, you know, my parents all this time, they just thought I was a full-time teacher and that's what I was going to do for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And I was going to get married to a nice Muslim man, live happily ever after.
Yeah.
Well, they were devastated, weren't they?
Well, you could almost have become a taxi driver because you know London so well. You could have... So that's another, going back to my earlier question, again, that's sort of fearless, isn't it? You having been encouraged to be a teacher, encouraged to do a degree in biochemistry, then you had to say, presumably you did tell them, I'm going to drama school. No.
They didn't know. Yeah. My parents
did they know you're a comedian?
No. They didn't know anything about me ever. They just knew that I was teaching. And the first time I told them I was a comedian was the night before I was going to be on Have I Got News For You.
Right.
And I was on with Boris Johnson.
Okay.
And it was the first time I'd ever done Have I Got News For You. And the night before I told them I'm a comedian and I'm going to be on Have I Got News For You. And they never took it seriously.
No.
They thought I'd won a game show. And that was my prize.
All right. Yes.
To be on Have I Got News For You for the night.
Yeah. So they're basically laughing at you.
They were in denial.
Yes.
They were in, and it was weird because every time I went home, they would never talk about me being a comedian. They'd talk about, like, I remember them talking about the Kardashians one night.
Yeah.
They'd be talking about Trump. They never mentioned that I was a comedian. It's never been talked about.
Oh, right. Ever. Even now?
No, they don't talk about it.
Okay. So
it's always a secret. They know I do it. They've seen me on TV, but they never talk about it.
So are they expecting you're kind of taking a little bit of a break and you're going to be back and you'll be head of science at the local comp
I think that's what they think.
Yeah.
They're in total denial about it.
Yeah. But is that something that you require bravery to be able to cope with that without that sort of parental support?
I think maybe some of it was brave and then some of it was just stupid and some of it I just didn't give a shit.
Yeah. Because you don't just do it, you know, here, there and round London or around Birmingham. You go all around the world.
I know. And they just ignored it. They just thought I was, in their head, I'm teaching. I'm a science teacher. People would stop my dad in the street in Birmingham and go, we saw your daughter on TV. And he'd go, yes, that's right. But, you know, she has a degree in biochemistry. You know, she went to university and she's a science teacher. And they'd be like, yeah, but we saw her last night on TV. Yes, but, you know, she's a scientist, you know. Totally in denial.
But do you do the equivalent of sending postcards from New York or Dubai or Hong Kong or Australia or wherever you've performed?
I used to, and they'd ignore it. They'd ignore it. Yeah. And I remember going home and they had a sack full of postcards upstairs in my dad's bedroom that they'd obviously read, but they just ignore it. Put it under the bed. They can't cope with it.
So Glyn Jones is your wonder, not because he necessarily achieved great stuff with you, but at least he tried and was prepared to give you.
He believed in me.
Yes. Right. So your third wonder is Queen's Park, which is your local park in Birmingham.
Yeah, I grew up in Birmingham. Obviously, I don't live there anymore because I'm doing well.
If there's anybody in from Birmingham, let's apologise.
Not tonight, but generally, I'm doing quite well. I mean, it looks quite nice now that it's finished. I mean, it looks really good, you know.
Did you not go back for the Commonwealth Games? Or
I hosted the Commonwealth Games.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
Yes.
You know, that one.
Yeah.
I hosted the opening ceremony at the Alexander Stadium.
Yeah.
And that was a really great laugh, and it was brilliant. And in Birmingham, it looks really nice.
And did you open with, I don't live in Birmingham anymore because I'm doing well?
I certainly did not. I don't shit in my own hometown, do I?
Yeah.
No, I said, I love Birmingham. You can get anything for a pound in Birmingham. Yeah. You can go to the Bullring Market. Everything's a pound. You can get a bag of fish and a bag of knickers for a pound. Yeah. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's true. And so I love it. I loved Queen's Park because when I was growing up there, it was the place I used to go to all the time.
Right.
And I used to write stuff. I used to keep a diary. I kept a diary since I was 8 years old. And I used to sit in Queen's Park and I just used to write all the time.
All right.
I never thought it would amount to anything. But that was the place where I used to go all the time.
So what sort of park is it? Is it sort of tennis courts, grass, bowling green, that sort of thing?
It used to be, and now it used to have bowling. All the old men used to play bowls, and I used to be fascinated by that. I used to watch them playing bowls. Had a tennis court, and I used to be really good at tennis. I used to play tennis all the time.
Yeah.
And there's none of that now. It's all been demolished. It's just a park. It's just got nothing.
Oh, right.
And I go back, though, but this memory is still there of everything. Yeah.
So what would you say why it rates as a wonder? It's a
wonder because it reminds me of where I came from, which was nothing.
Yes.
And look at me now. I'm here.
A triumph, yes. Okay. And is it better than, is it just because it's your local park, or is there, are there aspects park. Of it that you
I
would
spent
recommend?
A lot of time there. I spent a lot of time there. I grew up there in Harborne in Birmingham.
Yeah.
It's very, very normal, very ordinary. There's nothing spectacular about it. And I think of like where I came from, and it was like nothing. It was so ordinary.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you're not selling it as a wonder, but it's you're calling it ordinary.
But it's wonderful.
It's wonderful. Okay, good. So your next wonder is Boy George.
Yeah, Boy George. You know, when I was growing up in Birmingham, I didn't know. I knew Boy George was gay, but obviously I was still in love with him, and I met him one night by accident. I escaped through my bedroom window when I was 14 and I went to a nightclub in Birmingham.
Right.
And obviously my mum and dad were in bed. I'd escaped through the window, went to this nightclub, which was a gay nightclub, and I went with my gay friends, and it was called The Nightingale, and there was a lot of drag queens on there, like Lily Savage used to play there, and it was very gay. And I bumped into Boy George in there one night.
Right.
And I got chatting to him and I said, I was 14. I said, oh my God, I love you. I think you're amazing. And,
yeah.
You know, and he said, what do you want to do? I said, I think I want to be in show business.
Yeah.
And he said, right, well, you need to get some training. You need to get, he was telling me all this advice. Anyway, the Birmingham Evening Mail that night, they took a photo of us.
Yes.
In this club, me and Boy George. Mm. And it ended up in the Birmingham Evening Mail, which my dad buys every day.
Yes.
So there's a picture of me with Boy George in a nightclub in the Birmingham Evening Mail. I'm 14. I'm never leave the house. How am I in the Birmingham Evening Mail with Boy George? And obviously, the people had rang up my dad, said, your daughter, we want to, there's a story, the picture here, there's a story. And my dad said, no, that's not my daughter.
It's Chappie Corsandi, he said. So that's.
And it was me.
Yeah.
And it was in the Evening Mail.
And did he ask you about it and say, look here, people are saying this is you?
Yeah, he was furious. I was banned. I was not allowed out of the house ever again. And I never left the house.
So they put a lock on the window or something?
They locked me in there for months and months. They used to drive me to school and then drive me back and never let me out.
Yes. So that's a very strict upbringing.
It was
you were sort of rattling the cage the whole time, were you?
I thought I was in show business because I met Boy George.
Yeah.
I thought, my God, I've met Boy George. This is it. This is a sign.
Yeah.
I'm going to be in Culture Club.
And did you keep in touch with him and write to him and say, enjoyed...
I mean, I stalked him.
Yeah.
I used to write to him all the time. And he told me, he said his favourite film director was Pedro Almodóvar. And he said to me, you look like his favourite actress.
Yes.
And I never heard of this person at all, Rosie De Palma.
Right.
He said, you look like her. You should write to Pedro Almodóvar and say that Boy George has told you that you should be in the movies.
Yes. That's how it works, isn't it? That's
I bloody did it.
Oh,
though.
You did?
I did it. I got a letter back from Pedro Almodóvar's production company.
Yes.
Saying that, you know, you need to be a professional actress for us to consider you. Yeah. And I've still got the letter.
Right.
And they gave me all this advice about what to do.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, when you're 14, you are fearless.
Well, some people are, but you evidently were. Were you keeping that in your head when you just got, you know, you went to Rose Bruford and you got your.
I thought I'm gonna be like Penelope Cruz.
Yes, and
look at me now.
Have you gone back to them and say, look, I've been to drama school now. I'm doing a bit of stand up as well. I got some success. I'm available. Yeah,
I did write to him a few years later, and just when I needed him, he didn't write back.
Oh no.
When I was 14, he was all there writing me letters. Yeah. And then when I was a bit qualified, he didn't want to know.
Well, there's a lot of people out there in show business, to be honest. But they've mostly been rounded up and taken away. But we hope.
I've got to tell you, I did write to Jim or Fix It as well.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Yeah. When you were 14?
And when I was,
yes.
And I got about three or four letters back from them.
Right.
Thank God he didn't make my dreams come true.
What was your dream? Was it?
It was ridiculous. It was something like I wanted to be on the set of Dallas.
All right.
And I wanted to meet J.R. Ewing and all this. And
well, they could have arranged that. I think that was. I wasn't a big follower of the program, and certainly not anymore. but obviously the budget would have to extend to an air flight. But I'm sure they could have gotten them to agree.
On there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So you went to drama school.
Yeah.
Was that because you thought you needed some drama training to be a comedian, or did you have more of an idea of wanting to act?
Yeah. No, I thought I need some training, and I want to be on stage, but I didn't know when I wanted to be a comedian, so I just went on. I just thought I'd go to drama school.
Yeah. And has it helped? Have you learned skills there? Do you sometimes use fencing in your stand-up act?
Or I have to
learn how to ride on a horse to come.
Teaching was the best thing.
Yeah.
Teaching was the best training. You know, I'm into controls, you know, these rowdy 16-year-old kids. That was the best training. Because then, you know, heckling and stuff and people and hate mail and death threats is nothing compared to that.
So I suppose you probably did get heckled a lot in when you're teaching, because as a young teachers in particular get a lot of hassle,
I taught in Tower Hamlets. I used to teach Dizzy Rascal. That's how, you know, I don't know if you've heard of him.
I have, yes. Dizzy Rascal, we're all fans of... So was he the boy in the corner?
Or boy in the corner. Yeah, that's really good. That was his album, Boy in the Corner.
That's why I said it. Then,
do you know why?
I was subtly suggesting I might know a bit about him.
Do you know why he was... The album was called Boy in the Corner.
Because you put him in the corner.
That's right.
Yes.
Because we were always telling him, get in the corner.
Yeah.
And that's why he was called Boy in the Corner.
You should get a royalty for that. You've basically created the lyric.
Yeah, but it was that kind of kid.
Yes.
That we used to teach.
All right. So you handed on your enthusiasm for perhaps some music and show business.
It weren't me. It was the music teacher, Mr. Smith.
But maybe not the biochemistry, or possibly that as well.
No.
Who knows?
I think that's why he turned to music.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So your next wonder is a scrapbook of all my plane tickets and boarding passes from all over the world of where I've travelled to do gigs. So is this an actual one that exists? You keep
everything. Scrap. Like when I started comedy, I started getting gigs in all these strange places. Like the British Council took me to Kosovo. They wanted me to go and do a gig in Kosovo one night.
When there was the war on that kind of stuff?
It was just ended and they had asked me to go and do a gig in a cave in Kosovo.
Oh, wow.
Me and a Swedish comedian.
Yes.
This is the British Council's idea.
Yeah.
I stood in a cave on a Friday night. Swedish comedian goes on before me. He had a Swedish accent, but he was talking in English.
Yeah.
There was no electricity. There was no microphone. It was cold. There was nobody was sitting. Everybody was standing.
Yeah.
It was freezing cold. It was dark.
Good training for the Edinburgh Festival, I'd say. But that's okay.
And then
did he do?
It was difficult.
Yes. Yeah.
And then I had to go on after him
and
do comedy another hour. And they didn't really understand what we were saying. So I just went through somebody's handbag.
Yeah.
And they thought this was hilarious.
Yes.
And for an hour, I managed to get some laughs.
Oh, right.
Going through some woman's handbag. It was so strange what she had in there.
Yeah. So these were Kosovans who spoke a bit of English rather than expat soldiers or something.
And there
British
were soldiers there.
Yes.
There were some soldiers.
And did they get the hang of you a bit
they
more?
They did a bit.
Yeah.
It was a very strange situation.
Yeah.
But anyway, I got my Kosovan plane tickets. And then next week I was in Sweden or Denmark or Norway. And I went to some strange places that they sent me to. And so I always thought I'd just I can't believe I'm going to these places. I never thought I'd go to these places.
Yeah.
And I kept all the plane tickets and kind of luggage tickets and stuff. And I put them in a scrapbook and I've kept them all.
Right. And what's going to happen to this scrapbook? Do you think you'll keep it throughout your entire career?
It might go into the National Museum, or the British Museum. Yeah. The Queen might like that.
Yeah.
I just thought that I'd keep these things because they evoke memories. And then I can remember the places I've been to and I can write about them.
Yeah, well, probably very useful, but you've got to be prepared. Sounds like your career is going so well. This is going to occupy your whole house or your flat or something.
I've got about 10 scrapbooks.
Yes.
A4 scrapbooks with all these plane tickets on and everything.
Yeah. And do you keep sort of like reviews and you know, things from the papers? Or
I don't keep reviews.
No, all right. Well, that's...
They've mainly been shit. I've had some terrible reviews. But are you
I'm sure you've got...
You remember them mentally.
Yes, you don't need to.
The awful, awful reviews you can never get out of your mind. And when I first started comedy, I had this agent. She was terrible. She used to make me read all my awful reviews.
Oh, right.
And she used to say to me, read all these and remember them and improve on it.
Yes.
But the thing is, you never improve on it. They just scar you. Yes. And they're just awful memories of what people said to you. So you don't need a scrapbook for that because you'll remember them.
No, that's true. I think it was Kingsley Amis had a good line on that. He said, you should let a bad review spoil your breakfast, but not your lunch. Yeah. What he meant was, you know, have your upset. Oh, what did he know? What he's talking about? And then forget about it because there'll be a good review coming along. Or if not... there's no good being put off by somebody just writing about it because you've had to do it. And that's my... I'm passing on that suggestion from Kingsley Amis. I don't know if he really meant it or whether he bore grudges for years and years.
I mean, everybody gets bad reviews.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
You know.
But novelists can get their revenge because they can use the name of the critic as an evil person in a later book. Kill them off, rather. Yeah. God, he was stabbed in the back several times. I don't know if that's available to you as a comedian. You could... create a joke
people
around
do, I mean, comedians do you know make jokes about their awful review. I mean, when I first started, I remember the Times, it said it was sitting in my comedy show was like sitting in a torture chamber where where I tortured my audience for an hour.
Yeah.
And she, the woman writing it, goes, and I had a lucky escape. For what?
It's unkind, isn't it? You're not enjoying the act. Just go. But then that's their job. You know, it's a reviewer's job to tell this is good, this is bad, I hated this.
I mean, torture chamber. That's going a bit far, isn't it? Yeah.
What were you doing?
Only telling jokes or trying to. You know, there's stuff like that. And then, you know, I've had reviews where they've reviewed me because they thought I was Shappy Corsandi.
Yeah. And then you don't mind if you've got a bad review then, isn't it? Shappy was absolutely awful tonight.
I know. And they've, you know, they've always compared me to other people and stuff like that. But you know what? You just get on with it.
But what about performing all these various countries? Do you have to take, if you go to America, where obviously people speak English, but then you've got to establish, you know, what Birmingham is, what your place in society.
It's a different kind of English.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't understand everything.
No, I know. But so how do you have to adjust your...
When I was in Vegas, actually, a few weeks ago. I did Vegas for 14 nights with some American comedians.
All right.
And Vegas is strange because they kept warning me about it because they said, you know, the worst of humanity is in Vegas.
Yeah.
So it's the worst of America. They come from all over America and they come to Vegas to gamble and, you know, have a good time. And not a lot of them have seen people like me before. And it gets very confusing because, like, when I'm in LA, they think I'm Mexican.
Right.
And I always have people coming up to me, speaking to me in Spanish.
Yes.
You know, when I talk back to them in Urdu and... It's a lot of fun. But when I'm in Vegas, you know, they got confused by me.
Yeah.
Because it's a brown woman talking in an English accent about things they just don't know about. And they thought I was doing a character.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of, you know, adapt to them, talk about them, relate to them, talk about America. What's it like being in America?
Mm.
They don't really want to know about you, and it's just too much of a jump.
Okay. But is that are you driven by ambition? You want to be successful in America, or you want to be a successful around the world?
I kept getting called to America
all
the time, like, because they kind of, you know, I don't know why, they do like to hear about immigrant stories and people that you know, from different backgrounds, because that's all they are.
Yes.
Are different backgrounds, and they kind of always are asking me to go there all the time. I keep getting offers to go to America.
Oh, well, that's good.
And I like to go for the experience.
Yeah,
and it's different. And,
yeah.
But I do find it difficult at the same time. There's only certain places I go where I do well. LA, New York, San Francisco.
Yeah.
Anywhere outside of that, I fear for my life.
Well, that sounds like a good selection of places to be successful. So again, let's go on to your sixth wonder, which is the River Ganges. Specifically, you say the foothills of the Himalayas. So that's its sort of source, isn't it?
Yeah, I went to the foothills of the Himalayas where I learned meditation.
All right.
I actually, I don't know. I wanted to learn meditation, and I'd been touring India. I'd been on tour around India, all over. And everybody kept saying to me, oh, you know, go to the foothills of the Himalayas. It's the River Ganges. It's where all the swamis, you know, they go and wash in the River Ganges. And there's this myth that if you wash in the river, all your sins will be forgiven and you'll all be washed away. And so I went there. I went to this ashram. I learned meditation there. It was really great. You know, they showed me where the Beatles had learned meditation, which was in this ashram down the road, which is all white, which is apparently where they wrote the White Album. And, you know, all Westerners are all taken by this, the Beatles learning meditation in Rishikesh. And I went there, and it is a spiritual place. There is something special about it.
Yeah.
And it was a great place to learn meditation. And I did wash in the River Ganges, and it was an amazing experience. It was kind of a life-changing experience.
So you did feel it washed something away.
I still carried on sinning, but I mean, it's a very amazing experience to wash in the River Ganges, because people think that the Ganges, you know, all these people are washing there, it must be dirty. Mm. But it's the water's pure.
Okay.
The water's clean, despite all these people washing in there. The water's clear. And I swam in there, and I washed in there, and I brought some water back. And it was every day I'd go and meditate there, and it was really great. It was really good.
The only bit of the Ganges I've been to or been near is the Hooghly River, which runs through, well, when I was there, it was called Kolkata. And the Hooghly River is sort of a... They've arranged a sort of canal, so some of the water Ganges goes into the Hooghly River.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how that works. It does flood sometimes, which can't
it's
really
a
help.
Really
it's a
fast.
Little bit. It's a little bit grubby there. I'd have to say as it goes through.
It's very fast flowing.
Yes,
I mean it can. You can get swept up in it. Different points of the river run faster than other parts.
Yeah.
So you have to get in at the right point.
So have you travelled around the Indian subcontinent, Pakistan as well?
I've been to Pakistan.
Have you been where your family originally come from?
My mum's from Lahore and my dad's from Islamabad.
Yeah.
And I've performed in Pakistan.
Oh, right.
I've done stand-up comedy in Pakistan 3 or 4 times. I've done some big festivals there. The Gaddafi Stadium, I performed there to about 1,000 people.
Yeah.
And then 3 days after I left, they blew it up. Some suicide bombers blew it up.
That's a bad heckle, isn't
I know.
It? That's yes.
So I'm not going there again.
No.
And,
did that work for you as a place to perform?
It went great. Mm. You know, people think it's repressed, but they love it, and they love the more filthier you are, the more edgier you are. They love that kind of comedy because they can't be that in their life.
Right.
So I've performed there, and I've performed all over India, which is great.
There's the thing about comedy, and this is a bad thing I'm saying, but there's quite a lot of alcohol gets drunk by comedy audiences and comedians, especially in sort of late night clubs. Is that something that you fight against, or it's performing in Pakistan? Presumably that's not the case. So you've got to be funny enough when everybody's sober.
Well, it's a myth, you see.
Yeah.
Because they're all secret drinkers.
Oh, are they?
Like in Saudi, they're all secret drinkers.
Right.
But I remember I went on stage in Pakistan. They were sober because it's public. They drink in secret in their houses and stuff. But I went on stage and I did this joke where I said, you know, I'd never drunk alcohol in my life, you know, because it's against my religion.
Yeah.
What isn't? but I had taken it up the arse a couple of times. It's a joke.
Yeah, it's a joke.
I only did it once, and I wasn't looking, so it doesn't count.
You've put that behind you now.
And they love that.
Yes,
they absolutely love that because They can't say that or they can't do that.
Yes.
But they would love to do it. So they laughed at all those kind of filthy jokes like that. They love that. I mean, in India, they drink a lot. So it's different.
So you were there. You're the naughty girl. They either want to be or want to meet or whichever way.
They want me to do the jokes. I get shot for them. They just laugh at them.
Yes. All right. So that's I've got to race on to the last wonder. This has been an interesting collection of wonders. And this one, again, what's this about? Ski clothes. Ski clothes.
Not skiing, but ski clothes. I went to do this gig at the Arosa Comedy Festival in Switzerland, up in the Swiss Alps. And I'd never skied in my life. I didn't know how to ski or anything. And they gave me, and they said, you can learn to ski here. So they gave me a free skiing pass, skis, but no clothes.
Yes.
To ski in.
Yeah.
And we're already up there. So I had to steal the clothes. I stole them.
Stole them?
From the hotel. This man was next door to me. And he left
took the clothes off his back?
He left them out one night to dry. And I stole them and wore them down the Alps, learning to ski.
Well, I would tell you that's against the law because I was a criminal barrister, but we're on strike, so I can't I can't tell you that information now.
But he was a lot bigger than me.
Yes.
And people were taking photos of me and everything.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was such a fun experience learning to ski in this man's clothes that I've stolen. And I just loved it. I had a great time.
So the wonder you have in mind, they are this guy's, the man who died of exposure later on that day, his ski clothes is your wonder of the world, or ski clothes generally?
Ski clothes that I thought they were it was so liberating, learning to ski in the Alps, in a man's clothes.
Yeah.
You know, wearing a man's clothes. I'd never done that before. It was all at once. It was everything, everywhere, all at once.
And has that given you a love of skiing now? Do you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I've been skiing a lot since then. I've been I've been skiing in Colorado.
Oh, right.
I thought I was really good, so I went to Colorado and I skied down some double black slopes in the Rocky Mountains. I thought I was fantastic. Nearly died.
Well, you're fearless again.
I'm fearless.
Because you've got to be fearless to be a skier, haven't you?
I always think if I could do this, I can do anything.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
So I just try.
So here's another career opening up, either as a skier or as a criminal, because
I'm more of a criminal. I steal a lot of stuff.
Well, once you start stealing ski clothes, you're on the slippery slope, aren't you? So that's. So ski. I mean, you mustn't make a habit of nicking things. That's.
I used to steal. I just used to get bored and steal stuff, but I've stopped doing it now because I don't want to get caught. Yeah.
But if you do it when you're a kid, is that what you're referring to?
When I was a kid, I used to steal people's lunch boxes and pack lunches. And I used to steal people's coats and then hide them. Yeah. And then when school ended, they'd be crying because they couldn't find their coats, and I just love it.
Yes.
Really disturbing behavior.
Yes.
I know.
So when you were a teacher, did you were you responsible for the moral behavior of your charges? Or?
Do you know what? I did something once when I was a teacher, and I'm not proud of it, but I was in a nightclub in Birmingham, and I met this drug dealer, and he got talking to me, he got chatting to me, and he said to me, "What do you do?" And I said, "Oh, I'm a science teacher." He went, "No way." Yeah. And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "You know what? I'd love some pestles and mortars because I need something to crush my drugs in."
Yes.
And I said, "No problem, no problem. I can get you some pestles and mortars." And the next day, I cleared out the cupboards of pestles and mortars, and I put them in a Sainsbury's bag, and I took them to him, and I gave him. I don't know why I'm telling you.
I don't know why you're telling me it either.
I gave them to him, I don't know why I did that.
Why? Because, whatever your view of drug dealers, they've got plenty of money to buy pestles and mortars from the chemist.
They wanted it from the lab, the real thing.
Yeah, they were cutting down their expenses.
They were.
Yeah.
And so I did that. Oh, I was bored, you know. It was fine. It was fine. It
I don't know whether we should be doing this interview or just having more counselling. We need a. Is there a probation officer in here?
Can I just say that I was a really good teacher?
Yes.
I know it sounds like.
Well, what about the lesson after you'd sold off all, or given off all these pestles and mortars, and you came to demonstrate how to crush the calcium to make something? Oh, well, you have
to
do.
I stole them from the lab next door and put them into my lab. Yeah. So,
have you any other offences you want taken into consideration?
I was a really good teacher, though.
Yes,
because I know it sounds all terrible, but I was really good, and they did really well, my students.
Okay. So would you consider doing more teaching, let's say teaching people to do comedy or the other things you now know?
You know, during the pandemic, you know, there was a shortage of teachers and they texted teachers to say, would you come back? And a lot of my friends, they got that text.
Yes.
I didn't.
Well, they couldn't. Your text might have been, please, could you come back and do some teaching? And could you bring some pestles and mortars, which
could
we're short of?
All the equipment you stole.
Yeah.
No, they just. I just don't think I could go back to doing it. It's very difficult.
Can you remember the biochemistry, the facts? And
it comes back to me sometimes. Yeah. But I couldn't remember it if I read a book or just went on. I could still remember it.
But you'd have more authority now because you're not only a teacher, but you say, oh, look, I'm also, you know, I appear on television. I've got this act. So, you know, they'll be more attentive, I would reckon.
I don't think that they would. Yeah. I don't think so, because I did go back and do supply teaching a few years ago because as a favour to my old head teacher.
Yes.
And all they wanted to do was take selfies in the corridor.
All
and
right.
So I think it'd just be a distraction.
Yeah.
So I don't think I should go back.
Well, that's not. I mean, I can see it's a bit of a distraction, but having kids that want to have selfies taken with you is one up from wanting to flick ink
stab
at you
me
or,
after,
what, or
after
whatever
school,
they did in
time. Or throw chapati flour over my car.
Yes.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
All right. Shazia Mirza, thank you for sharing your seven wonders with me. Now I have to choose the wonder of wonders from your list of seven, the one which struck me as particularly wonderful, as you described it in this podcast. Now, this is a bit tricky because they've all got their very different wonders here. I think sentimentally I'm going to go with Robin Williams because he's Robin Williams, your wonder of wonders.
Thank you.
Shazia Mirza,
thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you found us. Thank you for listening.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.